follow up on probably some of the things that have been being addressed in this symposium about interdisciplinary and collaborative research, the kinds of things Dan Rubinoff has talked about, things Jim Tomlinson was talking about, and the earlier speakers. I picked a title, I guess, about 6 months ago, From Transgenic Crops to Transgenic Pests, Science and Policy Issues. Given this symposium for graduate students, I think I'm going to be concentrating on the transgenic pest parts of this and the science more than the policy issues at this point. And I guess what I want to talk about, I guess, in terms of students is when you are choosing what to do, you do have to listen to a variety of people in terms of what you see going on and where you see a field going, where you see the future going to be, because you may be in this field for 30 or more years and you want to pick something that you ride a horse that you're going to enjoy riding. You don't want to get on a topic that's not going to be interesting to you, and you probably may not want to get on a topic that has already been researched to death. You might want to try something new. And I hope I'll give you a little bit of an example of that. So when we think about genetic engineering and stuff for crop protection or pest protection, typically this is what is being talked about. Transgenic crops, you see on your left-hand side, and the non-transgenic being fed upon by the corn earworm on the other side. And this is 15 years ago, it was a brand new field that many people questioned as to whether this would ever come to fruition. And today, millions and millions of acres are planted to that. But what I want to move to is a place where I think things may be moving. And today, there's a lot of question about whether or not genetic pest management is something that will come to fruition. And maybe sometimes called GPM, genetic pest management. And this is a field that requires an incredible amount of interdisciplinary interaction between ecology, molecular biology, and population genetics at the biological side, but also economics and ethics. And I'll talk a little bit about those. Just to show you, this is what we're talking about. A transgenic here, a transgenic Aedes aegypti, vector of dengue fever, which is expressing, has taken a blood meal, is expressing a gene in its midgut that will inhibit the dengue virus from replicating. I want to talk in this talk about the concept of genetic pest management isn't new, and I'll give you some examples, but there's a lot of exciting breakthroughs in molecular biology and population genetics that I think are going to move this field forward. And lastly, that there are lots of ways to fail in this approach, so it takes a lot of careful thinking and experimentation. In general, there are two general strategies in terms of genetic pest management. One is suppression or local eradication. The other is strain replacement. So in terms of suppression or local eradication, you want to go for the natural pest and cause changes in its genome that will cause local suppression. In strain replacement, you want to take this green or natural pest and change it to a different state genetically. I don't know if I can get this to okay. And red is always going to signify the genetically altered form. That is a strain that doesn't cause as much damage or does not vector a disease. So suppression or local eradication has sometimes been called autocidal control. And Nicole Benno, who's a graduate student of mine, found this great slide of autocidal control. This is what we want to get to happen here, right? Get these pests to get rid of themselves. So autocidal control or suicide. So how can we do this? But I said this is not a new field. And this is a picture of Edward Nippling in the 1950s. Who worked on in this field in the classic approach for suppression of local eradication, and for this he won the 1992 World Food Prize. And just to tell you a little bit about what his approach was, and this is called the sterile insect release technique, and some of you may know of this, especially the older people in the audience, but the idea was that you would irradiate males, let's see if we can get the point of it, and you would release those in the field where there were normal females, and after they mated, you'd get dead or sterile offspring because there was chromosome breakage in their sperm. And if you could release enough of these, for example, like a 9-to-1 ratio shown here, those genetically altered males would outcompete the typical males in terms of mating, and you'd get 90 or more percent dead or sterile offspring. So if you could continue to do that generation after generation, if this is the population on a log scale, and that's over generations, those yellow lines being those releases, if you continue to do that, as the population started to go down, you'd become more and more effective because the ratios you were releasing were higher until you would get to eradication, or that was the simple idea. And Nippling, you know, through perseverance and such, had successes with the screwworm fly, and they took this pest that caused billions of dollars, apparently, in damage to the cattle industry in North and Central America, and pushed that. That shows the eradication zone in colors being pushed over the years from 1957, when they started, through the late 1990s, where it got it all eradicated all the way down to Panama. So this is one of the incredible successes, but this took an incredible effort. And this shows one of the early factories for producing those sterile males of the screwworm. And this is the inside of the factory. Of course, since they feed on cattle, the artificial diet looked like ground up cattle, but that's the maggots or whatever coming out of production. And so this did work, and it had incredible success, but you needed this huge infrastructure to create a situation where you had these very high ratios. And I say 9-to-1, they were releasing 100-to-1 ratios of the irradiated males to the typical males. So the question is, with modern biology, modern molecular biology, and modern genetics, can we turn this around and make it more efficient so it could be used on more pests? Up till now, it's been used on a handful of pests, but it's not something that you hear about in most classes in terms of the general approaches to IPM. It's used only on specialized insects. So could you change that, increase the efficiency, for example, to the point that you could release one of those genetically altered males in a sea of 9 regular males, and basically that's an improvement of 81-fold efficiency. Could we get to something like that? And so what I want to talk to you about is where I think things are moving, and I think a field for people to start thinking about as graduate students, if they're interested in integrated pest management, is this field of genetic pest management. And it's something that's going to take interdisciplinary approaches. It has to really require interactions between ecology, molecular biology, and population genetics at the biology level, but also has to take into account economics and ethics. And I'll talk mostly about the biological realms, but we could maybe even have discussion about the others. So in the era of Nippling, for suppression or local eradication, it was basically one approach, sterile insect approach. For strain replacement, there were some approaches with translocations and interspecific underdominance, but none of those ever took off in a commercial sense. With the advent of molecular biology and transgenic approaches, that list has changed dramatically. And this is just a short list of some of the approaches that can be used for these two, for suppression or for strain replacement. I'm not going to talk to you about all of them this afternoon, but I will give you just an idea of some of the improvements that could be made. And these are all nascent things that are just getting started right now. So I'll talk on the suppression eradication about female killing systems, and then talk about some of the others that could be used either for suppression or strain replacement. So it's maybe appropriate that turn of the new millennium, in the year 2000, three papers were published on this issue of female killing systems. Two were empirical studies showing that you could indeed engineer Drosophila to have genes in them that would kill females but not males, and we did a more of a theoretical study on how this would work at a population genetic level. What is a female killing system? It's a way of engineering an insect so it's carrying genes that don't affect the males but only affect the females. Right? When we're dealing with a sterile release of males, when they mate, all the offspring die. Here, only the female offspring die. So in all of these, I'm always using red as the engineer trait, and here I'm using a lepidopteran here to signify having a locus that's red, meaning so the front wings is a locus with two alleles, And if you look at it more closely, this is what's inside that caterpillar. If this is diploid, so it has, these are two chromosomes, and each one having an engineered locus that has a gene for female killing. So this would be a homozygous insect that could be developed, and that has the female killing allele. And this would be a heterozygote, where the other wing is not carrying that, so it's heterozygote. And if you look at this at a more graphic level, if you were introducing those male insects that were homozygous for the female killing allele, and they mate with native females, all of the offspring are heterozygous, whether they're males or females. But remember, if this is dominant, it will kill only the females. So in this F1 population, all the females die, but the males go on to the next generation. So in the F2 generation, you have these male survivors that mate again with those females. In the sterile release, everything's dead, so there's nothing that goes into the next generation. And you see here, in the F2 generation, half of the females will inherit that female killing gene, and they will die. So you have mortality in the first, second, and third generation as those males persist. And as we all know, males don't contribute much in the way of reproduction of the population, so getting rid of the females is what's going to matter for control. So the question comes, what happens if you could put a second copy of those same female killing genes at a different locus on a different chromosome? So we have the Lepidopteran with both sets of wings, right, both loci having these female killing alleles. So it would look something like that in terms of what's inside it, in terms of the diploid insect that's homozygous at both loci. And if you release that in the second generation, all the survivors are heterozygous for both of those loci. And so when they pass those on after they mate, instead of half of those females being able to survive, only two out of the eight in this picture would survive. So you're having more impact. So with molecular techniques, you can insert, once you have a construct and you have a way of inserting it, you can insert it on lots of chromosomes. There are problems with inbreeding depression and such, but I'm not going to address that right now. But the idea would be that, theoretically at least, gee, you could add one copy on each chromosome. What would happen then? And that's actually a very difficult population genetic question. Paul Schlegelman, biomath department, solved that. And if you do a single release and you look at what's the difference between a sterile release versus these female killing approaches that you could get through modern biotechnology, you can see the sterile release, this is a 2-to-1 release, not a 9-to-1 release, a 2-to-1 release. And this is the log of the population over time. And you can see the sterile release has an impact after the first generation, but that's it. So after the first generation, it's a straight line. Whereas even one copy of that female killing thing persists in the population and pushes it down further. As you add more copies, you have more of an effect. And this is on a log scale. So you're winding up, in the end, with many copies causing very low survival. But of course, sometimes when you're adding those genes, molecular biologists and perfect, if you have a fitness cost associated with adding those genes, you get a very different picture. The sterile release is still not as good as the female killing, but you find out that it's better to put 7 copies in than 16. And it all depends on a lot of the details of the population genetics of the organism you're working with. So there's got to be an interaction between the population geneticist and the molecular biologist here. Paul did work with multiple releases that could lead to extinction. I won't go into the details, but even with fitness costs, if you release, like in a sterile release method, you can wind up getting extinction with a 2-to-1 release ratio, whereas the sterile release doesn't lead to that kind of decline. So you can see some of the molecular techniques can lead us to a more efficient approach. And the bottom line on this, if you look at the idea of one insect with female killing genes, could be equivalent to 7 to 59 sterile males, depending upon the ecological and population genetic parameters. So we have potential for improving it. And these strains, I don't know if Luke Alfie's here, but his company is producing these kinds of insects. So potentially, you know, we talk about going from a 9-to-1 ratio to a 1-to-9 ratio. Well, we're not quite there with this approach, but we're certainly moving in that direction. What I want to tell you about are some other more advanced techniques that are being considered and worked on right now. And the first one I'll get to are homing endonucleases. It's a mouthful. It's a wonderful word, you know. Homing endonucleases. What is a homing endonuclease? So a homing endonuclease as its name says, it homes. It's an endonuclease, meaning it cuts nuclear material. So when you see it here, this is a heterozygous individual. Austin Bird is one of the people who's done a lot of the work on this. It's inserted in a region of the chromosome. And this shows a heterozygote where it's inserted in one copy of the chromosome, but not the second. So that's the homologous normal chromosome. And what it has is a recognition site on the normal chromosome where it cuts, so endonuclease. So what this gene does is first it produces mRNA, produces the homing endonuclease protein, which goes back into the nucleus and attacks that site on the normal chromosome and cuts it. Then DNA repair leads to the chromosome that already has that homing endonuclease gene to insert in that site. So you go from being a heterozygote to a homozygote. And if you think about that, if you start with a heterozygote, when you're at very low frequency, you release these homing endonuclease containing individuals into a population, most of the mates will be homozygous for not having it. You would think that you'd come down to the offspring and you'd maintain this frequency of 0.25, but indeed you go up to 0.5. So it's some people call super Mendelian inheritance. Instead of it, the inheritance you would expect, it's increasing in copy number without any benefit to the organism. So these are sometimes called selfish genetic elements because of what they're doing. They're selfish in that they're not increasing the fitness of the individuals, but they're increasing their own frequency. So how can these be used for genetic control, especially suppression? Well, if you have this homing endonuclease that targets an important gene, I put cystic fibrosis down there, something that would be a recessive lethal. What happens is when they're in a heterozygote form, they're fine, they survive, but when they're in the homozygous form, they die because both copies of that necessary gene have been cut in half, and they have been inserted themselves in there. So if you have something like that from the molecular perspective, and you look at it from the population genetics perspective, you can start at a very low frequency. This is the frequency of the homing endonuclease. You start at a very low frequency and release those into a population, and they will, on their own, increase in frequency in the population. So this is one that has recessive lethality. If you started off at a gene frequency of 0.1, over time it goes up to a gene frequency of about 0.81. And actually, for this talk, I won't go into the details of this, but it pushes itself through the population because the homozygotes are being killed. And once it gets up to a high frequency, 81% of the individuals are homozygote and they die. So you wind up at an equilibrium situation where 81% of the pest or whatever it is that has it are dying. So only one-fifth of your population is reproducing. And so this could hold the population down. But the homing endonuclease could be used in another way. This was the recessive lethal approach. But instead of putting it in a gene that it disrupts, you put it in a gene that it doesn't, we're in a place like in an intron, someplace where it's not disrupting anything. And instead of having that, you add to your homing endonuclease a gene that might be an anti-pathogen gene, something that would disrupt, for example, the virus for dengue transmission. So you have a gene that wouldn't increase in the population, but you hook it to this selfish gene and watch what happens. If you release that, the selfish gene is pushing itself up in frequency, and the gene you want in that population, the anti-pathogen gene, is hitchhiking along. So what you wind up with is that homing endonuclease gene going to high frequency, but you've also transformed that population from one that vectored dengue fever to one that no longer vectors that disease. So this is all coming along. Austin Burt has a $9 million grant or so from the Gates Foundation to work on these kinds of things and has a lot of interdisciplinary cooperation. What I want to finally talk to you about is the Medea element, another selfish genetic element. And it's called the Medea element because the females that have it in heterozygous form, when they mate with a normal male, half their offspring inherit that element and half don't. And the interesting thing is that those ones that don't inherit it die. and Medea was the Greek goddess who killed her children, and this supposedly represents that kind of a scenario. But it's a very interesting situation, because if you think that one through, it's the same way. When you start off in this scenario, you had basically a 0.25 gene frequency between the male and the female, and in the end you'd expect to keep that 0.25 frequency based on just a regular Hardy-Weinberg kind of equation and Mendelian inheritance, but instead of that, it's moved up to 0.5. So again, this element is pushing itself into the population, and also called another selfish genetic element. The way it seems to work is you have a heterozygous mother. In the egg development, she's laying down a toxin in the cytoplasm, and it is a toxin that doesn't act until embryogenesis, so during gametogenesis it doesn't work. Half the gametes get that Medea element. When it's at low frequency, the sperm is not going to contain that element. So half of the offspring will contain one copy of it and half won't contain any. And the interesting thing is that something happens in the embryos that have the Medea element, and that basically that toxin is removed, and the embryos that don't have it have that toxin and die. Now, I'm just giving you this as a schematic. People don't know how the naturally occurring elements, like in Tribolium beetles, actually operate, but they have some idea. The same kind of general population genetic factors go on. You have a little bit of a different trajectory, but basically you put that element in at a 5% level and it can take off in the population. And if you link that to a gene that decreases the ability of the insect to transmit a pathogen, you've had strain replacement and a lower problem. So it was a very interesting kind of idea in the natural situations. What we envision is that there is a maternal toxin, this element really is basically at least two genes, one producing the toxin during the maternal part, and then the zygote itself having an antidote for that. And Bruce Hay and some colleagues at Caltech who were studying apoptosis, who were doing very basic biology, thought about this and said, gee, it's going to take a long time to figure out the one in Tribolium and other insects, and we don't know if we can move it to other organisms. How about if we try to make it ourselves? And they did. And they got a paper in Science for that effort. It took them quite a while to figure that out, but they built a selfish genetic element with two parts. And I won't, again, go into the molecular details of this, but basically they developed something that had an RNAi-based kind of maternal toxin, and then the antidote for that was actually coming up with a different sequence for the same gene that was necessary in embryogenesis, so that could be rescued. So if you get it, if the mom has it, but the offspring don't get that rescue, that altered genotype, they will die. And they put this into Drosophila, and this is kind of a small picture of it, but they put it in at a frequency of 0.25 in numbers of populations and watched the trajectory as the normal individuals disappeared from the population. So I guess what I want to say here is this is the first demonstration that we actually have a gene drive system, and now people are trying to move that into Aedes aegypti and couple that with an anti-dengue gene. And just to say that, on the other hand, you do need to have a gene that will stop transmission. And Ken Olson and his colleagues have been working on anti-dengue constructs. Marcelo Jacobs Lorena and his colleagues have been working on anti-malaria constructs, and there are others who are working on these things as well. What I showed you in the first picture was the mosquito that, after a blood meal, was expressing RNAi that would stop the virus replication. And this is the construct that Ken Olson had that basically led to this. It was genes from the dengue itself that would lead to RNAi. So I want to close by saying that I've talked to you a lot about the molecular biology piece here and some about the population genetics, but we also have to realize that these are all simplified systems. We're working with Drosophila or lab cultures, so we need to consider more about the ecology and where these are going to be placed. And just to say that Tom Scott has been working with colleagues, Amy Morrison and others, in a city in Iquitos, Peru, that has 400,000 people, 40,000 houses, and they've been surveying Aedes aegypti to see just where it moves from from one house to another, how it reproduces, what containers it's in, and we're trying to develop models that take in all of the ecology of this insect as well as the genetics, so that when we're thinking about all of this molecular biology and population genetics, it can put in an ecological context and also into a social context of how are you going to wind up actually releasing these mosquitoes? How are you going to get community agreement that this is a good thing to do? So there's a lot of movement right now in terms of working on these kind of ecological and social issues, and that's why I say that you really have to come down in this picture to add economics and ethics. It wouldn't pay very well to do this kind of thing if you could control those insects better with an environmentally sound insecticide. So I would just say that I'm throwing this out to you to be thinking about it as students in terms of where you're going. If you're interested in insect pest management, this isn't only for use on mosquitoes, could also be used for agricultural pests. So thank you very much for your attention.